Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big
money at Menards. Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. My microphone is like up by my eyes. I couldn't really see you.
You're like stretch your neck a little bit.
How are you, Lainey?
I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tuesdays are my arch nemesis.
I know.
But yet here we are.
Every week.
Every time. Things will get better.
Yeah.
Things are going to get better.
Ooh. I think we've sang that before here on this.
Things are going to get easier. They really will. Like, I see my future getting a little bit easier.
Yeah.
When the children's summer program starts.
I was about to say, like, it's summer. How long do you plan on having them home? Like, when does this?
June 1st is when it starts.
June. Yeah, it's not far away.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You know what? Enjoy it.
You know, some days I do, and some days I'm like, I have to get this work done.
I know.
And it's not possible. But sometimes I embrace it and I'll be like, okay, I'm just going to do laundry. I'll just shut this down. I'll work tonight. I'll go upstairs and do some laundry and clean and do everything else that I have to do and just be a housewife, you know, just be like a stay-at-home mom. But yeah, I'm looking forward to a little more stability and routine.
Okay, so are you planning any vacations? Are you going to do anything for Memorial Day?
We might go to Oklahoma.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Are you going to Florida?
I still have not made.
You'll decide the day before, like
you're,
me.
You're exactly right.
I'm going to decide the day
this
before.
This is what I do. I'm a spontaneous person. I'm not a planner, okay?
Yeah. I do want to go to Disney. I have to put it on my calendar in order to survive.
Is this a friend thing or a family thing?
Oh, it's a friend thing. I tried to convince Daniel that we should go to Disney for Christmas or, you know, around Christmas time. He's like, no. And I was like, okay, well, then I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
So
Disney or bust.
I will Disney or bust. It's been too long. I think the last time I was there was in October, and that's just too long. That's too long of a time. Anyway, should we?
Yeah.
You guys, this is part two, by the way.
They came back for a reason.
Not to hear about my Disney trip.
No.
Although you will hear more about it once it goes on my calendar.
Mm-hmm.
This is part two of the List Family Massacre. If you haven't listened to part one, you'll want to do that. There's just so much that we discussed. We talked about the financial rise and fall of the List family and how all of it pushed John to the unthinkable, murdering his whole family. He'd been planning for it. Let's talk about how he pulled it off. So November 9th, 1971, when all the children went off to school, John List walked into the kitchen where his wife was sitting, having her cup of coffee. And he shot her in the head. He drug Helen's body into the ballroom. Then he went upstairs to the third floor and shot his mother, Alma, while she was getting up out of bed.
Oh.
This is so sad. As Alma fell to the floor, one of her knees broke.
Oh my gosh.
And so John was dragging her body into the hallway. And as we know from the confession letter in part one, He was gonna take her downstairs to the ballroom with everybody else, but she was too heavy. So he just left her in the hallway up there. When Patricia, his 16-year-old daughter, arrived home with her little brother, Freddie, John shot them both in the head and drug their bodies into the ballroom to lay with their mother. He went into the kitchen and made himself a sandwich, cleaned up a little, and then he attended his oldest son, John's, soccer game.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So he
ate a sandwich.
But in the morning, and then he waited till the afternoon. Like, what did he do through that? Just take a nap, go to the train station and read the newspaper.
He was planning. He was planning his next move.
Sitting and waiting.
He had a list. He was writing his confession letter. He was writing other letters, which I'll get to in a minute. So after John's soccer game, John Sr. gave his son a ride home. Wonder what that car ride was like. Wonder what they talked about. And shortly after entering the house, John Sr. shot his son. Again, according to John's confession letter, we know that John Jr. struggled. We also know this according to how many times he was shot. He was an athlete. He probably was still standing up and still, you know, walking about the house. And he probably said, "What are you doing, Dad?" Likely the same thing Paul Murdoch said to his dad when he was first shot in the chest before his fatal shot. John Jr., maybe he ran. Maybe he fought back. Mm-hmm. Maybe he threw some fisticuffs at his dad, but it took 10 shots to take him down. John Sr. drug his oldest son into the ballroom and laid him in line with his siblings. Their mother was laying perpendicular at the children's heads. I'll post some crime scene photos if you're on our Patreon. Earlier in the day, before his children had arrived home, John contacted the post office and asked for the mail to be suspended indefinitely.
Oh.
He said, "You know, we'll no longer need to receive mail here."
Well, that's suspicious.
Yeah. After he murdered his children, he contacted the boys' school and said they would not be back to school for a while because the family was going to North Carolina for a few weeks. He also called Patricia's drama teacher, as we learned in part one, and told them that, you know, she wouldn't be trying out for the play because she would be on vacation with her family for a while. This reminds me of Chris Watts when he disenrolled his girls. This was before people knew they were missing.
Yeah.
He called the school and said, "The girls won't be going to school here anymore."
Yeah, I mean, that just shows the level of planning.
It's like, okay, we got to get this payment off. We got to get this payment off.
Right.
I'm not paying for this. So after the murders, John went to sleep in his home with his dead family. He woke up the next day, November 10th. Turned on the hymns and left the home. Yes, all of what I just said, all of it was true. Now, the community, once the bodies were found, were absolutely shook and scared. No one really knew Helen, but it didn't mean that they weren't mourning her loss. Like, they were like, "That poor woman," and like, "We never saw her." Lord knows what was going through their minds.
Like the shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Right. Shoulda made an effort.
Yeah.
And the children had lots of friends and they were involved in lots of activities in school and church. Besides having some people that cared for them, the heinousness of the crime itself, being murdered by their very own father, his wife murdered by her husband, his mother murdered by her own son. It was going to take a really long time for them to come to terms with that, if they ever could. And since no one knew where he was, they were pretty fearful. They're like, "Is he hiding?
Yeah.
If he's going to kill his whole family, maybe he's going to come kill us too."
Right.
Like, this guy has no limits. Reverend Eugene Raywinkle held a funeral for Helen and the children at the church, which was attended by over 300 people. Considering the family weren't super close with many people, I suspect much of the attendees were, you know, classmates and parents and church members who knew of them. The church bought a plot in the cemetery, and the four were buried side by side in Westfield Cemetery. But what about Alma? Well, according to the documentary Real Crime, which I'll link in the show notes, Alma's body was returned to her hometown in Michigan.
Probably where she already had a plot.
So maybe.
Or a family.
I didn't think of her maybe already having a plot there. I don't know who she was returned to. I don't know the details of that. But I know that Alma and Helen did not get along.
And churchgoers, the pastor probably knew that and maybe.
Well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. After the funeral, Reverend Ray Winkle published a letter in the paper appealing to John to contact him. He said, I will always be your pastor and I'm always going to be here to support you. And if John was going to contact anyone, it most likely would have been the Reverend, given that his confession letter was written to the pastor.
Yeah.
So right away, when the bodies were found, the confession letter made it clear that these homicides weren't something that John just decided to do the day of. The man was meticulous. He didn't leave out any details, and he had been planning this for a while. Though just how long he was thinking about murdering them was unclear. Let's see just what kind of financial ruin he believed he couldn't come back from. Police learned that there were two mortgage payments due November 1st, right before the crime. They were due to First Federal Savings and Loan, and they were not paid. I believe these two mortgage payments were the second and third mortgage.
Okay.
It wasn't a mistake that they weren't paid. He wasn't going to pay a mortgage on a home that no one was going to be living in.
Yeah.
Certainly not him. He could have used that for his new life. In review of his bank accounts, a safety deposit box was accessed November 9th at 1:37 p.m. Then on November 10th and 19th, he accessed his bank accounts again. From where is unclear. I get the 10th because that's when he left. But the 19th was interesting to me.
But this is in the 70s. But shouldn't they have some kind of idea of what branch he was at to?
Yeah, this would get you caught real, real quick in this day and age. Yeah. But from the court documents, it's not clear how much money John took with him because it seems that there was money left behind in the accounts. And just jumping ahead real quick, the verbiage in the State versus List decision dated March 29th, 1990, was that he abandoned his bank accounts. So for some reason, that just makes me think that he didn't take all the money. He had taken that last $2,000 out of his mother's account.
Mm-hmm.
But why he left some behind, I don't know. He left his wallet, his ID, his car, all of that was abandoned at the airport when they found it.
Mm-hmm.
So police felt daunted by this task. And I think we talked about this in part one when you were talking about like the manifests of the planes. They couldn't figure out which plane he may or may not have boarded that day. His car was found at the airport. This was presumed that he flew somewhere. They would have to go through every register, every manifest, and figure out who had been at that airport at any given time that day or the following day or the day after that. You know what I mean? And it just wasn't feasible. I don't know what, if any, of those records were electronic back then. It seems like that would be a whole lot easier to pull off today. But there was just one more thing he needed to do before he could walk away from his old life. In addition to that 5-page confession letter, he had also left letters in other drawers of the filing cabinets with bank account information, information on his mortgages, and anything anyone needed to know to wrap up his finances.
Like turn over the house to
whatever.
The bank.
Yes, exactly. One of the letters said contact the proper authorities, and another letter even outlined the burial instructions that he had for his family. But he left no money to cover that.
Oh, of course.
This is how warped the man is. He had to be in control to the very end. The beautiful white house with green shutters stood empty, almost taunting the looky-loos. You know, Lena, I'd have been looking in those windows.
Yeah, for sure.
People would drive by just to get a look. And kids were going inside to look around and even take stuff.
No.
Like take whatever they could find.
I couldn't.
I know. And you know, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. The police don't clean crime scenes.
Right.
So it was left the way it was. Nobody came back into that house to clean up. No.
No.
So the police ended up having to tape off the house. And they had to get an officer to post up at the mansion to make sure that nobody's going in there mucking around. They were still looking for John, and they needed to continue to preserve the crime scene. But that was not going to happen, not with all the trespassers, and not ever, because several months after the murders, the mansion burned down.
How?
The cause of the fire was unknown.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Either. I think it was the ghosts, to be honest.
Or, I mean, maybe kids who were...
Maybe it was... It could have been any number of things.
Yeah.
But the house burned down. It was leveled off and someone built another property a couple years after that.
I hope that they got plenty of...
Evidence.
I hope that they got plenty of evidence before that. Please tell me.
Lena, you get one shot, you know? When you go into that crime scene, you better make it count. Because when you walk out that door, you can't just come back in and all that evidence be admissible.
I know.
That's a defense attorney's field day, is to say, well, that was collected after. That was collected a week later. Mm-hmm. How do we know? You know, just like with the Idaho, they knocked down the house. But why? Like, why not take the jury back there? Why not? I mean, luckily it didn't go that way. But you just think, wouldn't you want the jury to see the crime scene for themselves?
I think it's very helpful.
I mean, going in and doing reenactments and, you know, there's stuff to be found, and you're right. You want to maintain access to that house and like pray to God that they got everything they needed. But yeah, it's nuts. Get it done the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So John fled to Colorado, where by November 22nd, 1971, so this is a couple weeks after he fled, he had filed for a Social Security card under the name of Robert Peter Clark, which is the name he assumed until his capture.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. So according to court documents, he didn't start working until that next year. But that's not really saying much because there was only 1 month left in the year, if you consider.
Oh, yeah.
End of November. So he did get a job and he resumed his life as an accountant.
Holy moly. Like, I mean, I know the 70s, it would be so much easier. Golly.
The 70s. He met a woman at church, a church social, in 1977.
Run.
And he married her in 1985. Yes. And I wish there was more we knew about his life on the run. And
yeah.
We'll get to that, why there's probably stuff we'll never know. May 21st, 1989, America's Most Wanted ran an episode about John List's crimes, which reached 22 million people. Now, we all know the name America's Most Wanted, but the show had only been airing for 1 year on Fox Network.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
The beginning of time. I know it was. Now, a forensic artist named Frank Bender sculpted an age progression bust of John List of what he might look like 18 years later.
18 years.
Yes. There's a really cool video that I'll link in the show notes. It's not a video about the bust being created, but the bust is being created in the video and it shows how he kind of does it.
Okay.
It's really cool. And if you see, it's uncanny. His bust, they've got an old picture of John and that bust in the middle, and then a picture from when he was arrested. And it's like the perfect flow.
Hmm.
It's nuts. So after the show aired, tips began flooding in. A call came in from Richmond, Virginia, from a woman who said that her next door neighbor looked exactly like the bust she saw on the show. And the guy she knew as Robert Clark was also an accountant and regular church attendee. Because, you know, in this episode, they're talking about what he did for a living, you know, his wife, his children.
I wonder if he saw the episode.
Okay, he didn't.
Oh, okay.
John had no idea about this episode because he was with his wife at a church function that night.
Of course. Okay.
Praise the Lord. No, really. So this tip was not something that the police could just ignore. They're like, wait a minute, this sounds too perfect. Let's just cross it off our list.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah. So they tracked down this Robert Clark and spoke with his new wife, Dolores Miller, who had no idea that she was sleeping next to a man that had a whole entire other life before her. And when it didn't work out, he just murdered them all.
And no qualms about it.
His wife and his mother.
Yeah.
So she had no idea. But they did find where he worked. So they went to his office and they spoke with Robert. And they said, are you John List? And he said, no. John List? No, I'm not John List. But John List had a scar on his neck. And so did Robert.
Uh-huh.
And John List's fingerprints matched Robert Clark's.
Well, isn't that interesting?
John could no longer deny that he was who they were looking for. John was arrested June 1st, 1989, after being on the run for nearly 18 years.
His poor wife, new wife, well, both wives.
Yeah.
They, wow.
And you know, it makes me wonder, had he seen his picture on America's Most Wanted, would he have killed that wife or would he have taken off? Like, what would he have done?
He probably would have just left without saying anything, I'm sure.
It was reported that he, when he went on the run and he became this Robert Clark, that he had dyed his hair dark.
Ah.
But there's not much more he could have changed about his appearance. He looked how he looked. Yeah. You know, it's not like he
maybe gain a little weight.
Yeah, I don't know. But like I said earlier, I really wish I knew all the dirty details about what he was doing with his life while he was on the run and living under the name Robert Clark. But it doesn't seem noteworthy at all.
Mm.
Because if you think about it, his life before was not noteworthy.
Right.
He had made new friends, acquaintances, really, much like in his previous life. But he still remained a very private person. He went to work. He went to church. He went home. That was it. No one that knew him during that time could believe what authorities were saying that he had done.
Wow.
And to my knowledge, his wife never spoke publicly, and I didn't hear any mention of children. I saw one report that the stepfather, the movie The Stepfather, was based on John List's new life, like insinuating that he maybe had stepchildren. I didn't look further into that because I just
didn't want to bring them into.
Yeah, I mean, and Brenda, when Reverend Raywinkle published that letter in the paper appealing to John, like, please contact me, Brenda also did. So Helen's daughter, who was now grown and seeing that he had murdered her siblings and her mother, she just was, she begged him to contact her. Now, the following year, 1990, John stood trial for 5 counts of first-degree murder. The defense said he suffered PTSD because of his time in World War II and Korea.
I mean, it's not a likely minimizing story.
But that none of that came up in his confession letter. So they called the murders a midlife crisis. They said that John was severely religious and not in his right mind at the time of the killings. Which,
obviously, I think that's,
there's a difference between insanity and not being in your right mind. Okay. Dr. Sheldon Miller testified for the defense, explaining that John was convinced by his wife Helen to watch pornography to spice up their sex life. Anything to get the spotlight off of him. Say, well, look at this.
It's always someone else's fault.
It is. A clergyman from the Lutheran Church also testified for the defense, saying that he heard Helen berating John in 1961, saying that if John was half the man her first husband was, then he wouldn't have money woes. And he was really surprised to hear this because they were, you know, doing okay. Like, he was moved. They hadn't bought the mansion yet. He was working his way up. But this was probably a big reason why John bought that house that was too big for them, that they could not afford. Helen's sister Betty even took the stand, describing Helen as the one who wore the pants in the family. She said the last time she went to see her sister in 1968, a few years before the murders, Helen was very ill, and she spent most of that time in bed. Betty said that you could tell Helen had just been laying around in bed for a long time. The sheets didn't look clean.
Oh, no.
The room was cluttered and unkempt. The floors were dirty. You could just tell she hadn't been taking care of the house. But nobody cared about any of that. Nobody cared what Helen did. Nobody cared what the children could or could not have done. They found him guilty and sentenced him to 5 life terms and moved him into a different type of mansion.
Oh.
The New Jersey State Prison.
Well, there in Trenton. You go.
You know, it was a home that had many more rooms he was accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
It just sucks that he only got to see one for the rest of his life. Now, in 2002, Connie Chung, lover, she interviewed 76-year-old John List in prison about his crimes for about 4 hours. I couldn't find the entire interview.
Oh, man.
It's lost to the annals of time.
If
you're listening and you, like, I'm not kidding when I say I spent hours looking for that interview.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to live somewhere.
I would love to listen to that.
I could only find snippets, but the snippets I found were like almost enough for me. There are lots of other reporting and like articles about her interview, and they discussed what he said, some of the questions she asked. So I took those with the snippets that I saw. They discussed why he did what he did. And all this time later, he still hadn't changed his reasoning. He said he knew what he was doing was wrong, but there was just no other way to spare his family the embarrassment of the financial ruin that they were about to endure. She confronted him about having lunch at the same table where he had earlier shot his wife in the head when she was having her morning coffee. Remember? He kills his wife, drags her body, waits all day, kills the kids, has a sandwich at the table that no doubt has blood still all over it, before he attends the soccer game.
I mean, that's a level of insanity right there.
And Connie says, "How could you?" And John said, "I was hungry." And he kind of chuckled.
No remorse. No remorse.
He said, "I was hungry."
Wouldn't you make yourself a sandwich? I mean, come on, duh.
All those years later.
It's not funny.
No remorse.
Wow.
He talked about the murders themselves with no emotion. He said the first to be murdered was his wife, Helen. He snuck up on her at the kitchen table, shot her in the head, and he couldn't believe how much blood came out of her head. He said, "I just couldn't believe how much blood." And he said, "I knew what I was doing was wrong, but I'd done this one and I had to do the rest."
Yeah. Once you start, you got to keep going.
He was like, there's no turning back at this point. And she asked him, "Why didn't you just kill yourself after you killed your family?"
Well, he's too selfish for that.
Well, that is the reason. That's not the reason he gave.
Okay.
He said that if he killed himself, he wouldn't go to heaven. He thought that if he lived, if he kills his whole family, they're all in heaven. If he lives, he confesses his sin, gets forgiveness, he'd live out the rest of his life, low key, don't do anything else wrong. And upon his death, he'd meet back up with his family in heaven and they'd all be together again. Connie said, "If you see your family in heaven, what do you think they will say to you?"
I love that question.
I love Connie Chung. Yeah. She would ask anything. John said, "That's what I've often wondered. But I feel when we get to heaven, they'll either forgive me or they won't realize what happened."
La La Land.
Yeah.
He's got some kind of disillusion.
Yeah. And he told Connie that the longer he lived out as a free man, the more he believed that he'd never be caught.
Oh, I believe that.
I believe that too. And I think had that neighbor not been, there were many tips that came in, but I just wonder,
would any of the other tips have led them to him so quickly?
I mean, the likeness was unbelievable. So yeah, I do think he would have been caught immediately. But the fact that he was practicing as an accountant again, he had the same exact life.
Well, they say when you change, like if you're going to change your name,
keep everything else the same.
Yeah.
So the lie's easier.
The lie is easier. Yeah. Exactly. So that doesn't surprise me.
And that's probably why, like I said, there's nothing to know about his life on the run. He just was married and goes to work. He did the same exact thing he did before. I would just love to hear from the wife about what their life was like.
Yeah. Oh, bless her heart. She probably don't even want to. Oh,
I would go into hiding.
No, yeah.
John died in prison at 82 years old in 2008 of butthole disease. I'm kidding. don't remember what his cause of death was. But I'd like to think it involved something really painful in his butt.
Who even are you?
I am me.
You are you.
Yeah, I don't know what he died of, but he's dead. And you know what? Maybe he's reunited with his family.
No, I don't think he is.
Maybe not. You know, when he said, "Maybe I'll get to heaven and they won't realize what happened," from a biblical standpoint, that makes me feel sick because I believe that. Like, I believe that when we get to heaven, we won't remember the trauma that we had.
Well,
I don't know.
I mean,
will we?
You won't be thinking of what happened on Earth.
It will be a new life.
Yeah.
Like my dad, I used to ask my dad all kinds of questions because I was a very curious teenager, and some of the stuff I heard in church, I was like, come on.
You needed it to make
sense. I needed my dad to explain. Yeah. And my dad knows a lot. So I asked my dad one time about heaven, like, will I know you in heaven? And he said that the Bible says that we will be known as we were known. And so when I'm thinking about this case, it made me feel sick, because some of the stuff that John was saying was like, well, we'll just be together in heaven and we'll have the life that we had. Like, they'll know me as their husband, their father, their son. And I was just like, ew.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I believe it to that extent.
Yeah, I don't. So he's not in heaven. So I'm going to go with he wasn't let in. He got up to the pearly gates and they're like, yeah, we don't have your name in the book anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean, that does happen.
You can take the elevator all the way down.
Down. Oh.
Till it gets real hot.
I just wonder if he really did he really think he believed in Jesus? Like, did he really think he was saved? Did he really think, okay, I'm just gonna ask forgiveness? And
he reminds me so much of a psychopath. Just the way he lived his life. So
I agree.
Remorseless. Everything didn't matter to him. It really, none of it mattered.
Well, you could tell by his response about eating his sandwich that he made.
Oh, God. And the way he speaks to Connie Chung, like the way he's got nothing. There's nothing. Even at 76 years old, when she interviewed him, he was hollow. He was haunted by nothing. You could just tell he was affected by nothing. He was like, well, I guess we'll see.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll see. At this point in his life, like,
he
already processed what he did and is like, I did what I did, but I asked for forgiveness. So it's just like,
that's the thing is, like, so most of the time when we talk about psychopaths, they're not religious. They don't cling on to any one thing. But with John List, I wonder if he was the psychopath born into this strict religious household where he lined up these ideals and said, if I just stay within the confines of this rubric, if I stay in this square and this square, anything can be manipulated. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It makes sense
in my head.
It's such a deep way of thinking, too. So it's hard to explain and put it into words.
But he still killed everybody.
He still killed everybody because of his faith. Because of heaven.
In his mind, he thought, that makes the most sense.
Yeah. It's just twisted. Really, it's twisted. It's hard. That's hard to put into words.
You know, I have a fascination, always have, for psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past few years, I would say that nothing stops me in my tracks more than a family annihilator.
Mm-hmm.
Someone that will say the only way to get out of this is to just kill
the people who you love the most, who you're supposed to love the most and care for and protect.
Like Chris Watts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of his behavior after he murdered his family, the chuckling on TV and the...
Mm.
He I mean, you look at the way he was raised. He's a psychopath. I mean, the only person that's like an outlier in my mind of the typical family annihilator is Alec Murdoch.
Mm.
He's very gregarious, very outgoing.
True.
But he is so much so that he will do anything, like I said, to run his simulation the way it needs to go. But that's the story of John List.
That was a wild ride.
Yes.
I can't relate, and I'm glad I can't relate to.
That's the thing, is when I think, oh, she snapped and killed her husband, or she chopped his dingling off and put it in a, because you hear these wild things, like you see the headline, Florida woman chops husband's penis off, and you're like, what? But then you realize that he was beating her and she just got tired of it. And so there's some times that you can think, well, I can see how they snapped. Like, I can see how that went down.
Okay.
You can just never get your mind to make it to this
to plan place. To meticulously plan each, even to call the kids' school,
the schools,
and
the mail.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, he knew exactly what he was doing.
And that's the thing, is at no point did he feel like he was drawing attention to himself. He felt like, I'm just going to do all this stuff and I'm going to leave.
Yeah, like,
and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to leave it all behind, and whatever chips fall, and wherever they fall, mm-hmm.
I'll deal with it as it comes.
And he just left. You can bring your mind to some places in understanding. And this is just not one of those things.
No.
Athena absolutely. Strand is just not one of those things.
Absolutely not.
It's just unimaginable.
Yeah. I don't know. Humans are weird creatures.
Really weird. Really, really weird.
But wow.
Yeah. I would like to talk to our parents about this, because, you know, they're teenagers.
Yeah.
When he's on the run, and like, I wonder what they, you know, like, where's Nancy Guthrie? Where is Nancy Guthrie? Were they doing this? Were they saying things like, where's John List? Why can't we find John List?
Yeah. Where is he at? Could he could be anywhere. He could be in.
Where is Nancy Guthrie?
Yeah. And see, times are so much, like, there's so much more to go with this day and age. And we can't find Nancy, but we can find John.
That's right.
Huh? I mean, yeah, it's what a story. I'm glad he was found.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that the List family got justice. It makes me sad for Helen, the secrets that she kept,
the life she lived,
the sickness. I feel terrible for her. I feel sad for the kids. Who knows if they came home every day from school and tried to take care of their mom and make her life a little brighter? Or was it just miserable? That's sad to think.
It's really, really sad.
But it sounds like they really tried to have a good life, you know, as siblings and in their extracurriculars. And thank you for telling us about their short-lived lives.
I know. So sad. And Alma, like, there's not much reported about her and her life and what all she accomplished in her life other than having the spawn of Satan as her child.
And was she excited that she got to
end
her life in this mansion and her own little apartment up on the third story or wherever?
Dude,
it was.
I would. I'd be walking around in my caftan blowing in the breeze in front of the open windows, and I'd be like, look at me. I'm the lady of the manor. I totally would.
Oh, yeah. I believe that.
If my girls don't have a mansion for me to die in, yeah, then forget it.
I'll make sure of it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Although this house that you built is very beautiful.
It is, but it's not haunted.
It's not. You know? Haunted.
But maybe I built it on an ancient burial ground. Who knows?
Time will tell. Weirdo. See, humans are weird. Oh, let's just end it here.
Yeah, okay. Let's end it on this. Give me one more kiss. Man, I wish I was at the Sphere watching No Doubt.
Aww.
Okay. Let's end it on this.
Well, this was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review wherever you listen, and consider joining our Patreon for bonus episodes every month.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook for case photos and to stay up to date with the latest C-on-C news. If you have a case suggestion or just want to tell us how cool we are, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.